talking about indirect detection, which is the detection of the final state particles from dark matter annihilating in astrophysical objects, or galaxies and galaxy subhalos. And so what we did was we wrote down this master equation, which allows us to relate the particle physics parameters, like the spectrum of particles, the fraction of energy, of particles that give you certain energy, with the cross-section and the mass, and then also astrophysical quantities, which is the density of dark matter along the line of sight. Okay. And then we were specifically focusing on the case of gamma ray production, where we saw that by closing a loop, you can produce photons like this through a charged intermediate state particle. We could also produce photons through radiation off of the final state, and a bunch of other processes that I showed, like pion decays and whatnot. So what we're going to do is try and look for the gamma rays that are coming from dark matter annihilation. So are there any questions about anything that we discussed yesterday?
So just to recap, so the first process gives rise to like protons and other kinds of cosmic rays, right? And the second one is the photon.
That's right. So it depends on your specific model. So for instance, there are models that give you annihilation to predominantly hadrons. We call that maybe hadrophilic dark matter because it mostly couples to quarks. You could also imagine a dark matter model where it only couples to leptons, in which case you'd be mostly producing, you know, electrons and muons and whatnot. Now, it's hard to completely turn off the hadronic production, because if you can produce tau leptons are heavy enough that they decay into hadrons, some, actually most of the time. So you usually end up with some kind of hadrons in the final state. It's very generic to end up with some charged states. It's the only standard model stable states that are neutral are neutrinos. Okay? And they come in a doublet with charged leptons. So you basically can't turn off the coupling to charged stuff.
And then the second one, the photon energy is typical of the mass of the dark matter?
That's right. So if we ignore anything like this, so now we have 2-to-2 scattering, where we have chi-chi bar goes to gamma-gamma. And let's do it in the center of mass frame. Okay. If this chi is non-relativistic, then its four vector is essentially just m chi 0. Okay. So the center of mass energy here is 2 m chi. And then the I need to conserve momentum. So there's zero momentum in the initial state. I need to have zero momentum in the final state. So this basically gives very slow chi bar, going to photon in one direction, photon in the opposite direction. So by conservation of momentum, this has to be at E center of mass over 2. And this is E center of mass over 2. And this is just chi. Okay. Make this bigger. That's a good question. So obviously, there's going to be some broadening of this effect, but I, generally speaking, the instrumental resolution, which the fact that you can't very precisely pick out the energy of the photon, is going to be more of an effect than the intrinsic motion of the dark matter. Okay, so we can look for, so this produces a line, or a spectral line is what it's often called, where if I have energy and the intensity, or you know, this fraction, what you get is something that looks like this. Whereas the secondary production mechanisms give you something that falls with energy. The reason being that the emission of photons or is peaked towards the, there's these infrared divergences in QED. Similarly, if you produce hadrons which then decay into pions which then decay into photons, the photons only carry some small fraction of the energy. Okay, any other questions about the lead up to it? Okay, so there are a lot of telescopes which are looking for gamma rays. Probably the most relevant for now is called the Fermi-LAT, or this is a large area telescope. And Fermi is a general purpose instrument to learn more about gamma ray sources in the sky. It has sensitivity in the range of about 500 MeV gamma rays to about 300 GeV gamma rays. So this is perfect for the range that we might think of getting gamma rays from WIMPs. There's also heavier ones, HESS, and various other things which look at higher energies. Okay. And because standard model astrophysical processes tend to also produce spectra, which are peaked at lower energies, generally, the astrophysical foregrounds become less as you go out to higher energies. Okay, so astrophysically, the constraints on the flux are better at high energy. But if we look at our formula for phi, what we see is that this goes like the energy density of chi squared, okay? Or rather, I should say, it goes like the energy density of chi squared over the mass of chi squared. So what we see is that this is proportional to the number density of chi squared, because rho chi is just m chi n chi. And so the fact that omega chi equals omega dark matter, this fixes rho chi. So if I go higher in m chi, it means I go lower in n chi. And so when I go out to higher energies means higher n chi, sorry, m chi, which means lower n chi. And because the flux depends on n chi squared, this actually wins out over the improvement in the sensitivity at higher energies. So what this means is that the more massive dark matter there is, the fewer there are to annihilate. And so it becomes rarer and rarer for dark matter to annihilate. So when I go to very high masses with a very small number density, indirect detection is just not a good strategy because the density gets very low. Okay, and how does it work? Basically, it is a calorimeter. And what it looks for is photons that come in and scatter off of nuclei and convert into E plus E minus pairs, which are then their tracking layers and calorimeter layers. And it measures the energies of these E plus E minus, and it measures the direction of the E plus E minus, and it can reconstruct both the energy of the photon and the direction of the photon. And this is telescope is on the International Space Station. Okay? So you don't have to worry about the absorption or scattering anything off of the atmosphere. It's above all of that. Okay. And so far, we'll talk first about the Fermi dwarf analyses. So these are looking at these dwarf spheroidal galaxies, which are subhalos that orbit the Milky Way. These are dark matter dominated, so we don't expect there to be a lot of emission from visible matter. But the statistics are bad. So there's this trade-off. And so far, there has been no evidence for excess emission in gamma rays. This is true both in spectral features, lines, and in the continuum. Okay. And the strongest limits typically come from the continuum, just because the statistics are, once again, so much higher. So there's so few dwarfs, there's so little dark matter there by comparison to the galactic center that essentially they can even put limits by taking all of the gamma rays and saying, assuming that dark matter is producing all of these gamma rays, how much dark matter can there be? And they get strong limits on dark matter that way. So the limits are expressed in terms of the annihilation cross-section in units of centimeters cubed per second. and then the dark matter mass. And what I'm going to do is draw a line here at 3 times 10 to the 26, which is what, so I should say that these limits are for, typically expressed for Majorana dark matter. The reason is just historical. So this means that before we were talking about chi is not equal to chi bar. Here it's chi is equal to chi bar, and so the thermal relic line is at 3 times 10 to the minus 26. Okay. So here's 10 GeV, 100,000. So what the constraints look like depend on the annihilation channel, but you get something that looks like this. So this is for chi chi to BB bar, tau tau bar, WW, basically anything that gives you a lot of hadrons. And then this is for E plus E minus. And mu plus mu minus, the difference between here is a factor of 5 to 10 worth. Okay. So all of the cross sections above this line are excluded. So what we see is that if you annihilate to things that hadronize, because you get all of these neutral pions and all the pions decay into photons, you can actually exclude a thermal relic up to about 100 GeV, which isn't bad. And as we said, at higher mass, you have this fall off in the sensitivity just because the number density is dropping. Okay. And so really the best hope of indirect detection is sort of in this below a few hundred GeV. Okay. Now, of course, you can say, well, we're only sensitive up to 300 GeV, but of course, if you have a TeV dark matter, some of the photons are below 300 GeV, so that's why you can still get limits. At a certain point, it cuts off. I should say that, yeah, this is the thermal freeze-out value. Yes? It doesn't exclude the thermal cross section. Now, if you have theories where you're either not using thermal freeze out or there's some enhancement at late times, and I'll talk about ways that you can have that, then you can exclude it. So this line should always be taken with a grain of salt, because anytime people are saying, okay, we're going to take the thermal freeze out cross section and then apply it to this scenario, they're implicitly making assumptions about how you're doing that mapping. So for instance, dark matter is much slower now than it was when it was freezing out. So there are various ways you can get around it. So, but the point is that these experiments are actually sensitive to the real WIMP regime. Okay, so this is interesting, but unfortunately, we haven't seen any evidence for dark matter annihilation yet. Okay. And I should say that these exclusion contours match the expectation of, you know, given the amount of data they collected, this is what they expected to see. So they don't see any hints of dark matter in their data. Okay, so this is the dwarf. I now want to take just a few minutes talking about the galactic center. And remember that the galactic center is where there's a lot more dark matter, so you get a very bright signal, but there's also a lot of other stuff that's going on in the galactic center. And what's interesting is that there's actually excess gamma ray emission or E gamma that's about a few GeV. Okay. This was first pointed out by Lisa Goodenough and Dan Hooper in 2009. Dan Hooper is an astroparticle physicist at Fermilab. He's good at a lot of things, but one of the things he's really good at is finding inconsistencies in data and then proposing a dark matter explanation for that. But he has found a lot of inconsistencies in the data. And what's cool about Fermi is that Fermi makes their data public, and a lot of these experiments make their data public as a condition of their funding from the US government. And so you actually have physicists not in the collaboration who can analyze the data and find things that the collaboration is not finding. And this has now happened several times. All right, so if we subtract out the expected foreground emission, then what, and if you ever see any talks on this, which there are a lot of these days, what they plot is the energy squared times the number of photons per energy. The reason for this is that the expected foreground scales something like around e to the minus 3. So they still fall in energy, whereas things like both primary and secondary emission of photons will have a rising spectrum. So what's observed is something that looks like this, around 3 GeV. And this spectrum is consistent with chi-chi going to especially BB bar, but also other quark pairs, tau pairs, and recently it's been shown also Higgs's and W's and whatnot. Okay. But what has been mostly considered is chi is going to BB bar and N chi of around 30 GeV. And most remarkably, with sigma v around 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. Okay. And this is what's remarkable about this is that it's very bright. So in this energy range, this excess is about 10 to 20% of all of the gamma rays coming from the center of the galaxy, which is a lot. So it has now, Fermi has presented and shown that yes, it appears that this gamma ray excess is there. Of course, as I said, the main problem with the galactic center is that it's a bright place. And so, of course, the big question is it dark matter? Is it some other astrophysical object? Is it a mismodeling of their expected foregrounds? And we don't know at this point. Yes, Tibra.
How is the 3 GeV related to the mass of the 30
GeV? So the reason is that you have chi goes to B, B decays to charm, charm decays to strain. So the higher up in mass it is, the more cascades it goes through. And so the pions, to get a 3 GeV energy, you get BB bar is the best fit.
But if it's 30 GeV, then, I mean, the case to Higgs would be highly relativistic.
That's right. So for the Higgs, what they found was that if you can produce Higgses that are not moving too fast, they also give you BB bar from the Higgs decays. So their dark matter would be like 130 or 140 GeV. So this M chi is for BB bar, I should say. And that's received by far the most attention. But at first, it was assumed that the heaviest you could go is 30 GeV. Now, one thing that the Fermi analysis showed is that when you take into account systematic uncertainties on the shape of this spectrum of the photons, then you can actually, you know, tilt this a little bit, and so then you can start having more energetic photons and more massive particles. So it could be BB bar, and for a long time that was considered the best fit and the best candidate, but in the past few months, people have been writing papers showing, well, you can make it work with other things as well. Okay, now there's some features of this that are not consistent with astrophysics. So for instance, the gamma emission seems to be spherically symmetric. And we know that the galaxy actually, there's some visible matter disk, and then there's a spherically symmetric dark matter halo. So if you expect that this is coming from the disk, then this is a very weird thing to see, because it seems to be an extended emission which doesn't track the visible matter distribution. Yeah?
Sorry, expand the question. How do they figure out the spherical symmetric?
So what they do is they observe it at different latitudes, essentially. And they see that it follows a one over R, or an NFW type profile, and then similarly they point their telescope different longitudinal direction. So there are various there's this map of the galaxy where they sort of take the galaxy and unfold it. And what they do is they put different templates on. So imagine that it's spherically symmetric, so the emission should be uniform, or tilted in some way, and they find that the best fit is always when both axes are the same in both directions. Now, the main concern is that there are these things that are called millisecond pulsars. And millisecond pulsars are sort of the bane of attempts to find dark matter in indirect detection. Millisecond pulsars are very rapidly rotating neutron stars, which emit very high energy gamma rays. Okay. And they happen to emit gamma rays in a shape that looks exactly like this. So in many cases, the spectrum of millisecond pulsars and of dark matter is very, very similar. The thing is, we don't know how millisecond pulsars really are formed. And we don't know really where they're located, because we've only seen a very limited number of them. So people have made attempts to quantify this, and they say, well, locally we see this number of bright pulsars, and in the galactic center we expect there to be X many, and this is more than you would expect with doing a simple scaling. But that's not a proof. What you really want to do is see evidence for this in dwarfs, and as you can see, dwarfs aren't seeing anything in BB bar in this mass range. Okay? Dwarfs have actually excluded the thermal cross-section. So right now there is a conflict between a dark matter interpretation of the galactic center and a dark matter interpretation of dwarfs. Yes?
What would a signal look like?
Pardon me?
What would a signal look like?
Well, so the basic scenario would be somewhere like here, because it has a thermal cross-section and a mass of about 30 GeV.
So the line
would... that's right. So the limit would kind of go like this. Yeah. That's right. And, well... what I should say is that because these are mostly coming from continuum, you wouldn't be able to pin down the energy very well. It would look like a broad excess. And in fact, up until October, there was an excess in the Fermi dwarf analysis. Okay, so this got people really excited because they're like, we see an excess in the galactic center. So this, Dan Hooper likes to say, is a 40 sigma excess. Right? What that means is that this isn't a statistical fluctuation. There are so many photons that these photons are there. At this point, the question is it a systematic effect? Is it some astrophysical thing that we don't understand, or is it dark matter? Here, because the statistics are low, the excess that they saw was only about 2 standard deviations away from the expectation, and with a recent update of the data, it's now gone. So that excitement has fizzled a little bit, but as we'll see over the next few days, this is kind of the general story of dark matter detection, which is that some experiment comes and claims to observe something, another experiment comes and claims to exclude it. And there are challenges associated with comparing these. So for instance, the dark matter halo profile, this rho squared, looks very different for a dwarf galaxy than it does for the galactic center. So if we're just wrong in how we're modeling the rho, then it could be perfectly consistent to have a large annihilation cross-section in the galactic center and have a smaller flux in dwarfs. Okay. So the main problem with indirect detection is that we can't actually go and manipulate the experiment, for lack of a better word, that we're doing. We're just stuck with the sky as we see it, and we need to trust our modeling. And I think what this is telling us is that for now, we can't really trust our modeling, that it's a very exciting hint, but that until we learn more about millisecond pulsars, we learn more about their distribution, Until we accumulate more statistics on the dwarfs, then we're kind of stuck without knowing the right answer. And what is maybe encouraging is, I mentioned this in the last lecture, that it was recently discovered that there are about 8 new dwarf galaxies that have been found by the Dark Energy Survey. And so now Fermi can point their telescope at these dwarfs and get more statistics. And so hopefully increase the data set, because as we said, they suffer just from not enough photons in these ranges. Okay. So this is the current status of dark matter and gamma rays. So are there any other questions about these observations? Okay. Before we finish, maybe I'll move up here with indirect detection. I just want to mention a few other possibilities that we haven't discussed. Okay, one is measurements of the CMB. So remember, the CMB happened when you went from this gas of ionized particles just flying everywhere to suddenly everything was bound up in a neutral atom. And so this is very sensitive to ionization of hydrogen. So in particular, this CMB is happening in a dark matter background, because the whole reason we could tell the dark matter is there at the CMB time was that it formed these wells and that there were these oscillations that were affecting it. So this dark matter clumped right here. And if dark matter annihilates, it's injecting multi-GeV photons into temperature of the CMB at the time of the CMB was about 0.1 EV or so. So you're putting in, dumping energy that's 10 orders of magnitude higher than the ambient photons. And so what this can happen is you produce photons from dark matter, or not even photons, but electrons, protons, basically anything that's visible. They slam into the nuclei, and they can break the nuclei apart, they can break the atoms apart, they can do all kinds of stuff. And this tends to distort the CMB in various ways, partly by smearing out some of the features, because instead of all of this happening very fast, you have a period where you produce neutral atoms, and then some of them get reionized, and then they reform, and then some of them get reionized, and it kind of washes out some of the effects of the oscillations that we see. Okay, you could also do the same trick with Big Bang nucleosynthesis at the time when the nuclei themselves are being formed. The dark matter annihilating into very energetic visible particles can smash open nuclei. Okay. So the strongest constraint typically comes from the CMB. And the constraint looks something like this. Okay, and F is fraction of energy released that can reionize hydrogen. So for instance, the fraction that goes into neutrinos does not ionize hydrogen atoms, but things like electrons and muons do. And this fraction is usually between 10 and 40%. There's actually a lot of neutrinos that you can get. And of course, the annihilation isn't always efficient, or the scattering with hydrogen isn't always efficient. So this takes into account various things like this. So what we see is that thermal freeze-out models are excluded below about 10 GeV. What's nice about this is that the Fermi limits die off a little bit below a GeV just because the photons are not energetic enough to be seen in the detector. This is a strict inequality. So, I mean, these CMB constraints are very powerful, and the lower you go in mass, the higher the number density, and the higher your annihilation rate at the time of CMB, and this just completely kills you. So if you have things that are annihilating, then between CMB and indirect detection, you have to deal with quite serious constraints. Any questions about this? I'm not going to go into the details because they're a little bit too technical, but this is the general picture. Okay. And as always, there are caveats associated with these various limits. So what are the caveats here? Okay. So the assumption that drives our saying that it's excluded is that sigma v at t freeze out is equal to sigma v either at the CMB time or today. And this is not necessarily true. Remember that we wrote sigma v as some kind of expansion, okay? Well, let's not put the thermal averaging on for now. So sigma v can be written as some coefficient a, such some coefficient v squared plus some coefficient v to the fourth, plus dot, dot, dot. Okay. And all of our results so far, we're assuming that this is the dominant piece. But, and so this is called S-wave annihilation. And you probably looked at partial wave amplitudes in your undergraduate quantum mechanics class. This is the piece that dominates at low energy. But it may be that this is forbidden. And there are various reasons why. And you'll look at that in your tutorial. You'll derive cases where there is no velocity-independent scattering cross-section. So what this means is that the leading term has a v squared in front. And the velocity of dark matter is definitely changing over the course of the history. So the velocity at freeze out, it's about 0.3 or so. The velocity today, it's more in the 10 to the minus 3 ballpark. So you see that if you have a velocity suppressed annihilation, that when you square this, you get about a 4-order of magnitude different in the annihilation rate today versus in the early universe. So of course, if I take this plot, we're only excluding the thermal rate by a factor of a few. And so if I move that line, the dashed line, down by 4 orders of magnitude, we're not sensitive to it at all. Yes, super.
So why do you expect the velocity to
increase today? Yeah, so dark matter is non-relativistic, right? So when it's freezing out, the temperature is like m over 20 or something like this. So it's not really moving that slowly. Now, temperature is way colder than that. Okay, so it's essentially non-relativistic. And I will say that this velocity today is actually higher than it was at earlier times in the universe. It's because dark matter clumps, and when it's falling in, it picks up some velocity. So we say that it virializes the velocity of the dark matter. So there were times when the dark matter was maybe even slower than it is today. So you're right, this is just an effect of the expansion of the universe. And this was one of our base requirements of dark matter, is that it's cold and that it clumps. Okay. So this is something that you can't get around. Okay, so that's caveat number one. The second caveat is just the things that I already said about uncertainties in astrophysics. Okay, so it may be that if we're just completely wrong about the dark matter distribution, then maybe some of these limits don't apply. Okay. So there are other final states that one could look at, which we won't, but we'll maybe look at in a tutorial or later. So what you can have is dark matter annihilation to either E plus E minus or PP bar or deuteron, anti-deuteron, etc. As I pointed out, there are challenges associated with modeling the propagation of these things, but the key takeaway message is that dark matter produces a lot of antimatter. Okay. Basically, half of it goes into antimatter, plus half matter. Whereas astrophysical processes typically produce matter, because you take protons that are there and you accelerate them. So a major way of looking for these is to look at the fraction of, say, E plus over E minus as a function of energy. And then you can look for lines and things like this. And OK, it does depend on the propagation models, but seeing a ton of antimatter is still a pretty unique thing. All right, and then the last thing, which is sort of only recently been taking off, is Kai Kai bar going into neutrinos. So this naively seems like a really weird thing. But this actually turns out to have a very important application in dark matter capture and annihilation in the sun. So basically what happens is, if dark matter has an interaction with visible matter, here's the sun, it's a big mass. Dark matter can come in, it can scatter off of a nucleus at rest, and it can, the Chi loses energy and the nucleus gains energy. So what happens is the Chi loses energy and then it gets trapped in orbit around the sun. And so now if another dark matter particle comes in and gets trapped, and another one comes in and gets trapped, eventually you build up this very large amount of dark matter in the sun, and it starts annihilating there, because you have this sort of haze of dark matter right in the center of the sun. Now the problem with the sun is that it's a high temperature plasma of various things. If you produce electrons or protons, they're going to get absorbed by the sun. But if I produce a neutrino, which interacts only very weakly, it just shoots out of the sun. And so what you can do is you have these big neutrino detectors, and you just look for extra neutrinos coming from the sun, once again, at very specific energies. Because the sun typically produces things in the NEV range. Okay? And so seeing sort of spikes of neutrinos at above the GeV scale can actually be a sensitive probe. So we've gotten pretty good at looking for dark matter annihilation, all kinds of different final states. All of them have their various uncertainties, but this is still a field that's developing quite rapidly. And so the hope is that we'll actually get to see dark matter in its native environment and annihilating the way we expect it to. OK. So are there any questions about the last bit? OK, so that's indirect detection. Let's now move on to what's called direct detection. So indirect detection was looking for indirectly for the annihilation byproducts of dark matter. Direct detection is looking for direct scattering of dark matter in an Earth-based experiment. Okay. So we draw our picture again. Then thermal freeze-out happens in this direction, and this is indirect detection. Going this way is direct detection, which is Chi comes in, sees a standard model particle, and scatters off of it. And so this is really seeing WIMPs in the lab, which has some advantages, because I can choose the material, I can choose the experimental conditions, I can set it up to optimize it for dark matter scattering. I'm not just relying on what the astrophysics happens to give me. Okay? And there are many fewer uncertainties, at least on the the side of the detector because I can, in principle, understand the response of the detector and various things very well. Okay. So the topics we'll cover over the next 2 days or so. So first, we'll do an overview. We need to once again talk about the dark matter halo, except now what we care about is the local dark matter halo, so here on Earth. So then we need to look at what the kinematics of scattering look like. This tells us what we need to design our detectors to look for. And then we will focus on something that's called spin independent direct detection, which is a class of dark matter scattering scenarios that are the most powerful probes. So the basic picture is this. I have some hunk of matter. So this is some stuff. It could be often it's germanium, silicon. You basically want things that are dense, but not so dense that you can't see what's going on inside of it. Okay? So what happens is dark matter comes in, and it scatters. And of course, conservation of momentum tells us that if dark matter is scattering, then whatever it scatters off of also has to scatter. So what you get is you get a recoiling atom, or some recoiling bit of the matter. And it turns out, as we'll see when we derive the formulas, that the best thing to look for is a recoiling nucleus. The reason is that the reduced mass of the dark matter and whatever it's recoiling off of shows up in the kinematics. And so the cross-section is much bigger for a heavier object. It's just much more likely for dark matter to scatter off it. For an electron that's very light, it's often not going to actually scatter off of it. So what we want to be very sensitive to this tiny little single recoiling nucleus inside of this matter. And that's the challenge of direct detection. Let's go over here. So what my dark matter theory is going to do is, if I have a theory of thermal freeze-out, I can turn the Feynman diagram on its side, and I can compute the scattering cross-section. And this is going to translate into a rate of nuclear recoil. So how often does dark matter bounce off of a nucleus? And this tells me what my experiment has to be looking for. So we can express the scattering rate as follows. So the units that are often used is it's a rate, so number of hits per unit time, divided by the mass of the material. Okay, this is obvious because with a formula like this, I can figure out, you know, depending if I have 10 kilograms or 100 kilograms, it's easy to scale it. Okay, and then there's one over energy. So basically, we don't just care about the total number of recoils, but also we have to see the recoils. So we want to have the fraction that occur at any given energy. And this is just going to be given by the number of nuclei per kilogram of the material. Okay. What I can then do for the rate is calculate the cross-section per nucleus. Okay, and then I multiply by the number of nuclei. Then I have to multiply it by the dark matter flux. Okay. Remember that this is basically n sigma v, except it's not really thermally averaged. Okay. So this is just a rate. And then what we're going to do is we're going to divide by the energy of the recoil. So in an actual equation that you can use, we define this left-hand side as dr by der, so the rate per unit energy is the mass density of the target, the number density of dark matter, which is rho chi over m chi. And then because there's a velocity here, I need to integrate over the velocities that dark matter is coming in and scattering off of. So what I do is I integrate over velocity. This is the velocity of dark matter as seen on Earth. I'll write it out more carefully in a second, times the velocity, times the scattering cross-section per unit energy. So this is target mass density. This is the dark matter velocity distribution. And it's normalized so that D3V of F is 1. So it's basically the probability of dark matter coming at a certain velocity. The flux is just N chi times V. And then this is the cross-section per energy. So once again, we're sort of torn between there are things that the particle physics predicts and that we can set by experiment and things that we can't. So the things that we can decide are the target properties. We get to pick which element we want to use. If I'm a theorist, then I can say that I know d sigma dE recoil, because if I write down a theory, we've already learned how to calculate cross-sections for the theory, and this is just the cross-section per unit energy, some particular units. And I can also say what this mass of chi is, because I'm just proposing a theory. The astrophysically unknown objects are the dark matter density and the dark matter distribution. So all of the results that we're going to find for direct detection are still going to suffer from some of the same ambiguities in indirect detection, namely that I don't know exactly what rho chi is, and I don't know exactly what f of v is. And so there's going to be some, I should clarify this as f of Earth velocity. But we can at least take an ansatz for these things and figure out what the scattering rate is going to be, and then try to quantify our uncertainties in these quantities. OK, so are there any questions about this formula? Yes?
Sure. My understanding, there's no attempted creation or anything. You just are putting a block there, and you're just sort of waiting.
That's right. Basically, that's what you're doing. Yeah, you're looking for elastic scattering of dark matter. So you're not producing anything. You're just, and as we'll see, this is just, you know, non-relativistic kinematics, momentum conservation that you did in grade 10 or whatever. So, I mean, it's conceptually a very simple idea. The challenge is that dark matter, as we'll see, doesn't scatter very often. And so there's a lot of other stuff that's out there that can mimic this, you know, radioactive decays and various other, you know, thermal noise and whatnot. And so in some sense, the experimental challenge isn't the kind of general concept. It's like, how do I actually get my noise down low enough so that I can see this scattering? But yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So now we need to think about the local dark matter halo. And the problems with this are exactly the same as with indirect detection. The main difference is that at least with indirect detection, we can sort of average over some astrophysical region. So we can say, OK, in the center of the galaxy, you usually have this much matter density. Here, we're just stuck with whatever rho chi is at, say, the radius of the Earth. So once again, what we have is we have a disk, and we have this dark matter halo. But of course, we don't care about the dark matter halo here because we're sitting in the disk. And we wrote down yesterday what the dark matter profile looked like. I gave the equation for the NFW profile, but the only relevant thing is that it's sort of a falling distribution with radius. And we are at a very specific radius. The only thing that we can do is we can do simulations and say, given what we see about the Milky Way and given how much dark matter we expect there to be, what's the expected local dark matter density? And the answer is rho chi local is about 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed. So sometimes you'll see that they're like, I think at MIT they're making these, they have these little cardboard boxes which are about this big, and they say a one dark matter particle in one of these boxes. So if you have a 100 GeV particle, it fits in about a like baking soda kind of box. So that's the approximate local dark matter halo. And this essentially comes from simulation. The one thing that we don't know is that maybe there's some local fluid dynamic something or other, and we just happen to be in a place where there's no dark matter, and then we're just screwed. There's nothing we can do. Okay. So this is the main caveat that applies to these kinds of experiments. So this is how we determine rho chi. But what we also want is we also need this f of v. And we also get this from simulations. So the simulations give us this in the galactic rest frame. Because the dark matter halo is basically at rest in the galactic rest frame. So of course, you have dark matter moving here and here and all over the place, but it's net at rest. We, however, are not at rest. We are spinning in orbit around the center of the galaxy. So what we have to do is we first have to determine the galactic rest frame velocity distribution and then boost it into our current rest frame. So the form of f of v in the galactic rest frame, again, this is basically from simulation. There's some v bar that's defined. And it's essentially a Gaussian. I mean, this is just the Boltzmann distribution for velocities. Okay, so v bar is basically the mean velocity of dark matter inside of the halo. And it's about 220 kilometers per second. And that's about 10 to the minus 3 C. So this is where that number that came up earlier was. The escape is the escape velocity. It's about 700 kilometers per second. And this is just the statement that if dark matter is moving too fast, it's not actually gravitationally bound to the galaxy, and it will just eventually leave. So the velocity distribution has a cutoff. And so the shape of this thing just looks like, well, this is sort of an ugly distribution, but you get the picture. This is V escape. This is V bar. So what we then need to do is compute the Earth velocity. Which is just the shift, Tibra.
Sorry, the Gaussian is centered around zero, the way you've written it, right?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Sorry. This is in the boosted frame, which is not what we want. Okay. What's tricky is that the sun halo velocity is also 220 kilometers per second, so it's easy to get them mixed up. No, it has this shape. This is the characteristic V bar. Good point. It still cuts off at the escape. In the boosted frame, you end up with something that's shifted. And incidentally, it's shifted by V Earth Sun plus V Sun Galaxy, which is also about 220 kilometers per second. So, yeah, good catch. So really, V Sun Galaxy is about 230 kilometers per second. And V Earth is about 30 kilometers per second around the sun. So remember, there are two motions. There's us rotating around the center of the galaxy, and then we're also orbiting the sun. So the thing to point out is that we could also be in a funny part of the halo with respect to the velocity distribution. So one thing that n-body simulations do show is that sometimes there are these streams that have higher and lower velocities, so it's not always a uniform distribution. So we could be either lucky or unlucky. And again, there's not really a whole lot that we can do about it except for try and quantify that and put it into the uncertainties on our scattering rate. So for the very end, I'm now going to write down what the kinematic relations are. Oh, we're out of space. Bring this one down. Do people still need to look at this board? No.
You can always write behind.
I see. But they're still not going to be able to see all the boards at the same time. So. It doesn't solve the basic problem.
But it saves you from.
Okay. Good point. Okay. So. The kinematics, I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail because, as I said, it's quite simple. But we can use the fact that V bar is about 220 kilometers per second. This is definitely non-relativistic. So we can just use normal non-relativistic scattering. And this is just an energy momentum conservation problem where at first I have a nucleus at rest with a chi coming in at some momentum. And afterwards, I have chi that goes off in some direction, and the nucleus that goes off in some direction. Now, I don't really care about what the chi does because I don't see it. So what I care about is the nucleus momentum, which is q, which is called the momentum transfer. It's the amount of momentum that chi imparted to the nucleus and the angle that it's scattering at. And just using conservation of energy, it's easy to show that q is 2 mu v cosine theta, where u is the usual reduced mass. And the energy of the recoil is just q squared over 2mn. So these are all the usual non-relativistic kinematic formulas. And I encourage you to try and do this. It's not very difficult, but if you don't believe it. So if we, say, take a WIMP and a nucleus that has an atomic number of 100, so that's like a lot of atoms, just to give you a sense of the parametrics, Q is about 100 MeV, and E recoil is about 100 keV. And the reason for this is that they all have these 1 over mass type suppression. Okay. So because it's non-relativistic, you can see that Q is about 3 orders of magnitude lower than the mass. That's consistent with V over C. And then this energy of the recoil is Q squared over the mass of the nucleus. So the actual amount of energy that's being deposited is about 6 orders of magnitude smaller than the characteristic mass scale of the nucleus. So this is going to suggest that doing direct detection is quite hard because we're looking for very small recoils. And then tomorrow we'll actually write down the expression for the cross section and calculate what the rate is in a specific model. Okay. So are there any questions about the last 10 minutes?
Are there no astrophysical ways of determining the dark matter distribution around the solar system? Because it's all simulations.
Yeah, basically, yeah. So I would say the answer is no, because the solar system is dominated by the sun. And the sun exerts such a strong influence, and you have some essentially isotropic background that to infer the gravitational pull is very hard to do. So some people try to do it locally, like within our kiloparsec, by essentially trying to do similar kinds of things to the galactic rotation curves, or trying to see, you know, infer what the local dark matter density is from other properties. But I don't think anyone has actually successfully done it. And the basic problem is that we are somewhere where there's a lot of visible matter, which is good because we exist. But the downside of it is that where we're just sort of at the threshold where the galaxy is still dominated by baryonic matter. So the uncertainties on the dark matter distribution are very large. But yeah, ideally that would be great if we could just put a dark matter probe and figure out what that is. Okay, see you tomorrow.